Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin Chapter. Dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
This.
You're with us for the morning show as we explore police union oversight in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's been 2 months since George Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer who kneeled on his neck for 9 minutes. The officer charged with Floyd's murder had a long history of complaints against him, which were documented by the department. Some critics say police unions and the contracts they negotiate can shield officers from serious consequences when they're accused of misconduct. As Bridget Bowden reports, Wisconsin state law limits the power of police unions to share officer discipline more than in many parts of the country.
Like other unions, police unions negotiate with municipalities to determine things like wages, benefits, and how officers are disciplined when they do something wrong. Critics have said that some police union contracts negotiate away accountability for cops who may be abusing their power. Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, the state's largest law enforcement union.
We represent officers working in Wisconsin's towns, villages, and cities, as well as most of the deputy sheriffs.
He says the contracts in Wisconsin have little to do with discipline.
We don't have contractual language that insulates officers from having to cooperate with those types of internal investigatory interviews.
The advocacy organization Campaign Zero says some police union contracts enable officers to raise grievances about discipline against them, in some cases using an outside arbitrator to reverse disciplinary decisions and reinstate officers who've committed misconduct. A Wisconsin Public Media review of contracts in 8 major Wisconsin cities found that Green Bay, Kenosha, Madison, and Racine explicitly bar officers from filing grievances in an attempt to overturn disciplinary actions. The contracts in Beloit, Milwaukee, Waukesha, and Wausau do allow officers to file grievances in response to some discipline, which can escalate to arbitration. But in municipalities across the state, a different entity holds huge sway over police disciplinary procedures.
In Wisconsin, police discipline is in the purview of the Police and Fire Commission.
That's former Madison mayor and current arbitrator Sue Bauman. She says most police disciplinary proceedings in Wisconsin won't be decided by an arbitrator, but by a Police and Fire Commission. PFCs are required by state law for municipalities with 4,000 or more residents. The members are appointed by the mayor and are responsible for hiring and firing police chiefs, conducting disciplinary hearings, and doling out discipline for serious offenses, including firing. Just last week, the Milwaukee Commission issued a list of directives to Chief Alfonso Morales. The commission's executive director, Griselda Aldrete, made it clear that if he doesn't complete the list, he could lose his job.
Be it further resolved that failure to comply fully and promptly with these directives shall result in disciplinary action by the board, including discharge, suspension, or...
Bauman says the PFC system is far from perfect. The disciplinary process can be slow, and state law allows officers awaiting discipline to continue to collect pay.
Pending the investigation and then pending the hearing before the Police and Fire Commission has led to things being drawn out so long that people probably forgot exactly what happened.
Don Taylor is a professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School for Workers and has done paid work for police and other unions. He says the nature of police work and the unique power police hold to wield deadly force sets police apart from other public workers.
I would assume that law enforcement officers are probably subject to internal investigations much more frequently than folks that work in a nursing home or teachers or other types of public employee and private sector employee.
Given the stakes, it's inevitable that police misconduct and how it's handled will continue to be an intensely debated topic in Wisconsin and beyond. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And the story was reported in collaboration with WisconText and PBS Wisconsin. We're exploring this more with our partners at WisconText. They've just published a detailed look at the legal structures governing police across our state. Will Cushman is here, associate editor of WisconText. Will, welcome back.
Thanks, Kate.
So you looked at police union contracts in 8 major cities around the state. What were you looking for?
Right. Yeah, we were looking at the contracts in Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, Kenosha, Racine, Waukesha, Beloit, and Wausau. And we were looking for provisions in those contracts that have been cited elsewhere as being linked to increases in police abuses. So provisions that may shield officers from having to cooperate with internal investigations, may shield them from having to submit statements to interrogators, at least for a certain amount of time. And then other provisions that maybe could expunge their personnel records of disciplinary matters after a certain amount of time, things like that.
Well, it seemed as in Bridget's reporting there, there's not a simple template that's out there, that you found some variations from city to city.
That's correct. Yep. Well, a lot of the contracts language was kind of seemed like it was maybe from some sort of template. It wasn't so much so in some regards, particularly with rules regarding whether officers could file a grievance to contest their discipline. And all the grievance procedures in all 8 contracts that we looked at actually end in an arbitration procedure. And as Bridget mentioned in that story right there, half of the city's contracts that we looked at do allow for officers to grieve at least some forms of discipline. It kind of varied. For instance, in Wausau, the contract language was very explicit in allowing officers to file a grievance for any type of discipline that they receive. That was more explicit than any other contract that we had looked at. And then some other contracts, like in Madison and Green Bay, actually explicitly bar officers from being able to file a grievance for discipline.
Who has the power then to discipline police officers if the contract is shielding them from that?
That's a really good question, and it's kind of a complicated answer. So police chiefs are empowered to discipline officers kind of at a low level without input from.
Are you there, Will? I think we just got Will cut off. Can you hear us? I think we just got Will Cushman cut off there as we look at police union contracts, taking a look at the different contracts around the state as they get more oversight and more transparency questions. Will was looking at police union contracts in Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, Kenosha, Racine, Waukesha, Beloit, and Wausau. And you can join in. Do you think police unions provide adequate protections for officers, or do they leave citizens vulnerable? What role should the police union have? We're at 800-642-1234. As we look at police union contracts around the state and what protections that they provide, do you think police unions have too much power, or should all workers have the job protections that they come with that? What do you want to know about police unions here in Wisconsin and the laws governing them? Once again, that number is 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Going to go ahead and see if we can't get Will back on the line here. Stay with us. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're exploring police union contracts, protections, oversights here in Wisconsin. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In the wake of George Floyd's killing, police union contracts are under more scrutiny. Civilian oversight structures have sought greater accountability, transparency. But is it working? Are you an officer? How do you feel about your union contract and its provisions? Policing is dangerous work. Nearly 1,000 civilians are killed by police each year. FBI reports 89 law enforcement officers were killed on the job last year. Are these protections imperative to doing the job? Join in 800-642-1234. Will Cushman from WisconText reported on police union contracts in 8 cities around the state. He stays with us. So, Will, are you there by phone?
I am. Yeah, sorry about that.
No, it's all that technology that we got all around us. So as you were there, you were explaining how, police discipline works in the layers of contracts, but also the role of police chiefs here.
Right. Yeah. So police chiefs, I'm not sure where I was cut off before, but I was kind of explaining how police chiefs are empowered to hand out discipline at kind of like a lower level. But once it reaches a certain threshold, so it's like a number of days that an officer may be suspended or just discharged, that discipline has to go to a police and fire commission. And these commissions are the result of a very longstanding, over a century old state law. And they are appointees. They're appointed by mayors. In most cities, commissions are comprised by 5 board members. And they conduct disciplinary hearings and ultimately are responsible for meting out discipline if they feel it's warranted.
How common is it for them to act and release, some discipline or fire an officer?
You know, that's a really good question. I guess from my understanding, from the interviews we conducted and the folks we talked to, one of the kind of big criticisms of these PFCs, police and fire commissions, is that the disciplinary process can be really slow as they conduct hearings, as they conduct an investigation. Hear all sides of the matter. They're basically conducting like a mini trial. And while they are conducting these investigations and hearings, officers that are standing accused of misconduct and who are up for discipline, sometimes officers who are actually facing criminal charges are able to remain on the payroll. So they're continuing to receive pay.
Paid administrative leave.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's one kind of criticism of this model. Other criticisms are that even though they do amount to a sort of civilian oversight board, which has been something that activists have called for across the country, really, in terms of being able to better police departments by community members. Activists in Wisconsin, and particularly in Madison, have called for even greater civilian community oversight of the police department, saying that the local PFC doesn't provide enough. It's a limited board. There's only 5 members. They're appointed by the mayor. They have 5-year terms. So activists say that is not enough community oversight as they see it.
We're talking with Will Cushman, a journalist for WisconText, and his latest story examines police union contracts, how they work in some of our state's larger cities. Do you think police unions have too much power, or should all workers have the job protections they do? What do you want to know about the contracts here in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Charlotte joining us from Brookfield this morning. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello. He kind of answered some of my questions. I was just wondering who polices the police. And, can I change my question?
Sure, go ahead, Charlotte.
When the George Floyd thing was happening and the public was, screaming at the police, what could they have done different as the people? The people, could they have called someone that would have came out to stop them? You know what I mean? How do you police the police.
How do you police the police, Charlotte asks. Will, insights there on how you go about this?
Yeah, I think that's kind of what is playing out in places like Madison and in Milwaukee right now. As I just mentioned, there's calls for creating additional community oversight. I don't know if it would be like a board or some sort of group of community members who are empowered to assist in oversight of the police department, whether or not it's specifically in the realm of meeting out discipline for specific officers facing misconduct. I think that's still up in the air. And it's also up in the air whether or not these proposals would be legal under state law. So that's something that still needs to be worked out as well.
How much is transparency a role here? How, you know, you can get access to these police union contracts. You can read them and find out what is going on in them. But in terms of what happens with officers and how they are disciplined, how transparent is that for citizens to know about?
That's a really good question. And was one of the things that we were looking for when we were looking through these contract languages or contracts and the language in them, because we had seen in other places criticism about contract language shielding officers by allowing for their personnel records to be expunged of discipline that they had faced that had been recorded in them after a certain amount of time.
Oh, so that wouldn't follow them in the
right. Yeah, okay. So it wouldn't follow them. Exactly. Yep. And we found that the contracts in the eight cities that we looked at in Wisconsin didn't really have anything kind of arising to that level. The contract in Green Bay did allow for any types of notes related to disciplinary investigations to be withheld from an officer's personnel record if the discipline, if it turned out that the officer facing the charges of misconduct didn't actually get disciplined. But the records of that investigation still would be maintained at the department, but just not in the individual officer's personnel record. That was kind of the most similar example that we could find in the contracts to that issue. And it didn't really arise to the level that that activists elsewhere have said can cause some issues.
Let's bring in another call now. Phil is with us from Mount Horeb. Hi, Phil.
Hello. I am interested in balance in this issue, and I believe very firmly that the current passion and movement that is opposing our police forces, our law enforcement, is due to a couple of bad apples. We all know that the protesters, 99% of them, are peaceful and patriotic. But a couple of bad apples in the protesting group are creating this terrible image of the movement to improve our racial justice. In the same way...
And so, Phil, does this filter down then into union contracts?
It does, in that we need to have a public that supports our police force, not denigrates them, that says when a police officer is removed from the job, he hasn't been proven guilty. He has a family that he needs to support.
And Phil, I want to pause there because we are short on time. Will, do these contracts improve community policing in any way? I mean, are these contracts good for the force?
That's a really good question. And, you know, I talked to a couple labor relations experts who said that they really fear that the current environment could lead to further reductions in the rights for all public labor unions and union members. And I talked to a professor in Illinois who said, I quote, it's got to be able, a police union has got to be able to bring democracy into the workplace. Police officers need due process, he said. They need rights in the workplace. They need better pay. But they also have to be seen as bettering society and as working for the people to remain in the public's good graces. So I think that that kind of sums it up from that perspective.
Will, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Kate.
Will Cushman is associate editor of WisConText. You can find his reporting at wiscontext.org. Coming up, we look at the practice of trauma-informed care as it applies to immigrant children. That's coming up after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about trauma-informed immigration policies on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Associated Press and other news sources reported this week that the federal government is holding dozens of separated migrant children at hotels instead of detention centers as they await deportation. According to CBS, from March through June, the Border Patrol says it apprehended more than 6,000 unaccompanied children. Carla Marisol Vargas is an attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project.
They have suffered trauma, getting to the United States. And now they are suffering trauma at the hands of our government.
What do you want to know about federal immigration policies and procedures pertaining to detained children? We're at 800-642-1234. Jacqueline Nguyen is an associate professor in the Cognitive and Developmental Sciences program in the Department of Educational Psychology at UW-Milwaukee. Jacqueline, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Having me.
Before we get started here, I want to get your reaction to the news this week that the Border Patrol is holding detained children in hotels. What type of risk of trauma is that?
Well, I think the risks have been laid out in the science and developmental psychology for decades, right? Every time that children are separated from their primary caregivers, from the social support networks that they have and the people that they trust and rely on for care, it has long-term adverse effects on their development. It impacts their sense of security, their attachment relationships, leads to cognitive declines, social and emotional declines. I mean, in all the domains of development, this can impair growth.
You spent last fall on sabbatical focusing on the impact of immigration policies, visiting places like Tijuana, Mexico. What did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, that was a really fantastic opportunity that I was able to take advantage of. What I've been doing work on immigrant families, immigrant children and families for quite a long time, but I wanted to know what was happening on the ground, especially at the borders. Certainly immigration policies impact people all over, not just at border towns, but because of the rapid changes in our nation's policies, I kind of wanted to know exactly what was happening on the ground. And so I learned a number of things. I learned how quickly the policies can change from day to day and how chaotic the impact is on families. And that has incredible bearing on children's sense of stability and optimism and hope for the future if the target for them keeps changing as they attempt to seek asylum. It's incredibly difficult. So I was working largely in Tijuana, but had a chance to visit a number of shelters and visit with some binational agencies. And it was really interesting to see that that individuals were still really optimistic. I worked largely with asylum seekers and folks who were presenting themselves at the border with claims of persecution or the need to flee from their homes, of course. And individuals were patient. They were willing to go through the system. But again, the targets kept changing. And I think what really resonated with me was that parents and children just wanted a sense of normalcy. They wanted to play. They missed having fields to play soccer in. They missed going to school. They wanted to engage in any kind of, you know, even minor educational activities or, you know, arts and crafts that seemed to give them a sense of normalcy.
You were kicking a soccer ball around with a child. They went and grabbed the cell phone of their parent. What did they show you?
So this was a girl about 10, 11 years old, and we were just playing. She had been really withdrawn for much of the day and then started warming up. The family was working with some lawyers to understand their claims to asylum and to file the paperwork. So it is a really long process. She had probably been there for 7 hours that day. And as you can imagine, keeping a 10, 11-year-old still inpatient for 7 hours is an arduous undertaking under normal circumstances. And so we were just playing inside this office space. And she showed me on this, she went and grabbed the cell phone and she started just pulling up pictures of her father and family members in the hospital after they had been attacked by some government forces. And her father had passed away. She was there with extended family. And then she just went back and the family had taken those pictures and brought them as documentation of their need to flee persecution. And she just went back and gave the phone back and started playing again.
Oh. Are these families that you visited with mostly coming from Central America?
They are coming from all over, primarily Central America. I think that comprises the majority of the individuals who are presenting themselves for asylum at the southern border, at the U.S.-Mexico border. But individuals were coming from a large number of countries. I think on every given day, we were seeing individuals from 8 countries with the need for multiple language interpreters. Folks were coming from Russia or had Russian backgrounds, from the Dominican, from Haiti, from France, even. There were a number of French nationals, Caribbean nationals, Africans, Pakistanis. I mean, individuals were coming from all over the place.
I can imagine when it was shifting laws, regulations, and policies prior to COVID, prior to the pandemic, I can not imagine what it must be like right now for the asylum program as the pandemic is forcing so many people back to their home countries.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really acute problem right now. I spoke yesterday to a friend who I met in my first visit to Tijuana, and he had just been down there recently again, came back a week ago, and I was asking, you know, what the situation looked like, and it is dire. So whereas when we were down there, I had crossed at the San Isidro port, and there were a number of tents set up for individuals to live there daily, just as they were, again, awaiting their right to be heard. And I think there were maybe, you know, 5 to 10 individuals encamped permanently there. At this point, there are something like 40 to 50 encampments set up with people permanently staying there in really unsafe conditions, you know, lacking food, lacking access to running water, electricity, all of our basic needs. The shelters are overcrowded. Many of the shelters could house, you know, anywhere between 10 individuals or 10 families, up to 30 or 40 at the most. I'm sure they're still trying to maintain those numbers for safety reasons. There simply aren't enough beds or resources, but the shelters are absolutely overcrowded and people are really trapped. They have to stay in Mexico. There was a policy called the Migrant Protections Protocol that required that individuals stay in Mexico until they were they had their asylum hearings or had to be returned to Mexico if their asylum was denied. And now the numbers have grown exponentially.
We're talking with UW-Milwaukee Associate Professor of Educational Psychology, Jackie Nguyen, studies the developmental experiences of immigrants, refugees, and people with ethnic minority backgrounds, looking at the immigration policies and trauma-informed care of detained children. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Jackie, as these families await hearings, await what comes next, is there any structure for the children? Are there any educational offerings or distractions of any sort?
Yeah, minimal. I think, you know, there are groups and social service agencies, nonprofit agencies and organizations that have been doing this work for decades. I mean, immigration and the deportation of individuals and families and family separation is not a very new issue. It certainly has grown and taken the spotlight front and center as policies have exacerbated the challenges and the numbers. But some of these groups have been engaging in different services. I know that there is some organizing to bring mobile schooling to the various shelters, but the shelters are spread really far apart on difficult terrain. It's tough to get to. Certainly, schooling isn't happening on a daily basis. There are groups that are bringing supplies to the different shelters and folks in different encampments. And certainly some of those supplies are crayons and paper and arts and crafts materials. That's great, especially for the younger set of kids. And honestly, the kids will take anything. You know, one of the shelters that I visited, you know, the kids were all waiting for our group to arrive and they just wanted toys. They're like, okay, what toys did you give me? If, you know, forget educational activities, like give me a truck, give me a doll, give me something I can have fun with and cherish and something that might be my own or that I can share with others. I know the kids were, you know, for centuries, people have made play and engaged in whatever materials they have around them to have fun. So kids would play with chickens running around and so on. But there is nothing structured. Children cannot apply to go to schools in Mexico. You have to be a Mexican national in order to go to formal schooling. So really, we're talking about a patchwork of attempts to provide some stimulation. You can imagine the long-term cognitive effects of that, the physical effects. I mean, children aren't getting fruits and vegetables on a daily basis.
Literally little lives in limbo.
Exactly.
Yeah. Looking at efforts to move toward trauma-informed immigration policies involving migrant children, Jacqueline Nguyen is an associate professor of cognitive and developmental sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Are you an immigrant? What was your experience moving to a new country, a new place? How did you adjust to your environment? Were you a child when you came to this country? What do you remember about that journey? Join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Jacqueline Nguyen right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning about how to help migrant children recover from trauma as they are placed in U.S. detention centers and shelters. And as we're learning this week, hotels. The Trump administration is detaining immigrant children as young as one in hotels, sometimes for weeks before sending them back to their home countries amid the pandemic. That's according to documents obtained by the Associated Press. What questions do you have about the shared experiences of young immigrants and refugees? Have you worked with children who have recently come to this country? What is that like? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Jacqueline Nguyen is an associate professor of cognitive and developmental sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and she stays with us. Jacqueline, you've been collaborating with researchers around the country and participated in the Research Policy Collaborative. What is the effort there?
Yeah, it's a really fantastic effort run primarily by scholars out of Penn State University to translate or to connect scientists, so researchers specifically in family sciences or developmental sciences, with policymakers, and allow us to have a conversation so that the science can inform potentially policies that individuals are thinking about proposing.
What type of policies have come together around this?
I specifically have worked on with a few legislators who are interested, of course, on immigration and deportation policies. Most recently, Representative Lowenthal introduced an act. It was the Honor Our Commitment Act, in response to the Trump administration's reinterpretation of the Memorandum of Agreement to exclude refugees or to begin to deport refugees who had arrived in the United States prior to 1995. And this legislation, we worked with his office for a number of months, and they really were open to hearing about the science, hearing about the economic impact of deportation on communities, hearing about the impact on families, and understanding and using that science in the act. And in fact, they included a citation, I believe, in the legislation, in the bill that was introduced.
So he is a representative in California. What was the reaction by the congressman in terms of what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I think one thing that the Research to Policy Collaborative does really well is they approach all individuals, all members of Congress, to say, you know what, we're here. We're a group of scientists. What questions do you have? What are you interested in learning about? What legislation are you working on? And how can we help? And so the relationships that have developed have been primarily driven by legislators who are really interested in learning more about the science. I think they have to be experts on such a broad range of issues, whereas as scientists, we spend our lives committed to exploring a narrow set of issues. And so we get to interpret and translate in the broad range of research to individuals so that they can make decisions kind of on singular issues and bills. And so that office in particular, Representative Lowenthal's office, was very open to research. I think he was actually has a background in psychology himself. I think he was a professor before he came to Congress. And so so his office was very open, but other offices have been too. We've been engaged in a number of conversations with, again, a number of policymakers.
The situations at the border are dire. The trauma for these children, as you have seen, runs so deep. And immigration itself is such a heavily politicized issue. How do you navigate that and get policy to action? You know, connect all those dots in between.
That's such a great question. I think that has been the area of my greatest growth and learning as I've begun to engage in more of this policy work or engaged in translating science to policy. I think that it's certainly difficult in many ways. The what we do as scientists is, you know, we offer a set of suggestions and potentially implications and interventions that can be taken up. And it is up to policymakers to adopt some of those changes in many ways and to fund them. And I think individuals are really interested at the federal level in understanding, you know, what sources of funding they can use to target toward different initiatives that certainly align with their personal and political beliefs. But to the extent that we can offer really sound scientific evidence to say, you know what, this is real, right? So separating families unequivocally has traumatic impacts on children and families, and those impacts are long lasting. So what can we do at the policy level to curb family separation to begin with? Let's try and limit the trauma and prevent the trauma first. And then where trauma has occurred, as it has for over 6,000 family units, as reported by Amnesty International, what can we do once those families and children are reunited and in the United States, if they become integrated in our communities, what can we do to support them to facilitate, a developmental pathway where they can begin to flourish and thrive and have their personal traumatic histories met and understood and responded to with sensitivity and care.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with UW-Milwaukee's Jackie Nguyen, looking at trauma-informed care of migrant children and immigration policies. So when you look at some of those interventions and, that would be vital, that would be top-line priorities for you from a psychological standpoint, can you explain what those are?
Sure, absolutely. So, I should say with a caveat that I am not a trauma specialist. I'm coming into this work and learning from incredible colleagues who do work on trauma. I typically study kind of normative developmental pathways, but the context has made things not so normal, I think, for individuals. So I just caution that I'm not the leading trauma expert by any stretch of the imagination. But I think some of the interventions have to, again, address preventing the trauma. Families should be detained together if detention has to occur at all. The immigration and asylum seeking process is already traumatic in and of itself. Individuals are often seeking asylum because of traumatic events, either acute incidents, single incidents, or chronic trauma. And so just understanding that the immigration and asylum seeking process is a second layer of trauma is important. And I think there a lot of education needs to occur. I think we can also activate some existing resources and work with community agencies and groups that have been doing this work for a long time in order to provide support to them to continue to serve families impacted by some of these policies. To begin to support individuals multinationally who have been deported and are kind of in limbo, right? So individuals aren't necessarily deported to their country of origin. And so they're trying to find a new space for themselves and their families as mm-hmm. they kind of live perpetually, again, in limbo. So how can we support individuals to, again, flourish and thrive? How can we advocate for children, for example, to have access to schooling, even if they're not nationals? And then in the United States, I think we can provide a lot of support and services to families and children who still have long-term effects, even post-reunification.
Jackie, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, it was a pleasure. Thank you for discussing this important issue.
Jacqueline Nguyen is an associate professor in the Cognitive and Developmental Sciences program in the Department of Educational Psychology at UW-Milwaukee. Just ahead, we talk with the host and writer of the PBS show Prehistoric Road Trip. What dinosaur questions do you have? Bring them on, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.